This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross, who's off this week. For years, researchers have studied twins who were raised apart from one another for clues into how much of our personalities, intelligence, and interests are inherited and how much are products of our environment. No one's been more involved in those efforts than our guest, Nancy Siegel. She's a professor of psychology at California State Fullerton and director of the Twin Study Center, which she founded 20 years ago. She's also a fraternal twin. Siegel's new book is about three babies born and raised in Spain's Canary Islands off the Moroccan coast. Two of the newborns were identical twins, and due to a hospital mix-up, one of them was sent home with an unrelated mother who'd given birth to a single daughter. That child was raised in the wrong home as the remaining twin's sister. No one in either family discovered the mix-up until the girls were grown, and the resulting heartache and litigation became a national story in Spain. Siegel's book about the case and the issues it raises is called Someone Else's Twin, The True Story of Babies Switched at Birth. Well, Nancy Siegel, welcome to Fresh Air.
Lovely to be here.
Give us the basics of this story, where these twins were born, what happened at birth.
These twins, Begonia and Delia, were born in Las Palmas in the Canary Islands located off the coast of Morocco. When the twins were born, they were born just about the same time as a single child, and a nurse took one of the twins out for a procedure and brought her back to the wrong place in the hospital, inadvertently switching the twin with the single child. This caused the single child to grow up with the wrong set of parents and caused an unrelated pair of girls to grow up in a family thinking all their lives that they were fraternal twins. When they turned 28, the twin who was raised in the right family went to a shopping mall and was suddenly approached by a shop clerk who asked if she wasn't someone else. And she said no, and she just walked on. When she returned several days later with the girl that she thought all her life was her twin, the shop person approached her again and said, "You look just like my friend." And she turned to the sister and said, "You look just like my friend's sister." And the resemblances were so striking that a meeting was arranged for that evening. And it turned out that these two twins who'd been separated for 28 years realized that they really belonged together. DNA tests followed, the twinship was confirmed, and everyone's life just fell apart.
Well, there's a lot of twin research, and you've done much of it for many, many years. And I want to talk about some of what we've learned. But first, explain, if you will, the basic biology of fraternal versus identical twins.
Fraternal twins are created when a mother releases two eggs at the same time, and they're separately fertilized by two separate sperm from the father. And these children are no more alike genetically than ordinary brothers and sisters. They may look somewhat alike, but they may look quite different. They share half their genes in common on average. Identical twins result when a single fertilized egg divides sometime between the first and 14th day after conception. And these twins share 100% of their genes in common and, of course, look very, very much alike. The beauty of these two types of twins for researchers like myself is that we can use them to understand the genetic environmental influences on behavior by simply comparing similarities between identical twins and fraternals.
Now, just to back up, when these two twins were born in the hospital, wasn't the mom told that the twins were identical, and didn't she realize when she brought them home they were not?
Well, the mom who delivered the twins was told they were identical, except that she did not get them at the same time, and she never really spent time with them because she herself had a health problem. And she never thought to question the fact that they didn't look the same. A lot of people don't pay too much attention to identical versus fraternal. Maybe they do more now, but at that time they really didn't. And remember that they were under the influence of the former Franco regime, where people didn't question what hospitals did. And so even if one of the babies was a little bit more dark-skinned than the other members of her family, but she just rationalized that as a little bit of intermarriage back in my husband's family. The other mother, it turned out, received a baby that was a little bit lighter-skinned than the other members of her family, and she, too, rationalized on the basis of some intermarriage back in her husband's family.
Okay, so then at age 28, because they live some miles apart, the presumed twins are in an urban community, the one living alone is in a rural community, but eventually people recognize them, this chance meeting brings them together, and they discover this. I want to consider the reactions of all of the various parties here because they all have a unique position. But one of the things that's fascinating is that the two twins didn't tell their respective families immediately, did they? They kept it a secret.
That's right. The twins kept this a secret from their families because they feared the family's reactions. Imagine a mother raising a child for 28 years and suddenly finding out that it's not their child.
All right, so let's see how the different parties reacted to this emotionally traumatic information. Let's start with Beatrice. She's the one who discovers she is not biologically related to the sister she thought was her twin or to the mother who had reared her or her father and her siblings. How did she take this news?
Beatrice feared rejection by her family. She thought, if I'm not part of them, maybe they won't want me, maybe they won't love me anymore. All of her life, Beatrice felt different from her twin and from her sisters, and this was reinforced because she did not look like them, and she felt different from them. So her reaction was that she was going to lose a family and lose a twin. In some ways, you might say her reaction was the most difficult, but I wouldn't say that. I think everyone's reaction was just different. But nevertheless, she suffered tremendously.
Right. Tremendous fear that she would be rejected by these folks that she thought were her family. Now, her sister, or the woman she thought was her sister, was Begonia. She discovers that the sister she grew up with and loved as a twin is indeed not her biological sister. But somewhere else, there has been all these 28 years, a twin, somebody who looks and acts like her, who has lived a life apart. She meets her. Give us a sense of what this was like for her.
When Begonia first set eyes on Delia, it was shock and it was disbelief, perhaps an unusual look-alike. But the similarities were just too overwhelming, the way they looked, the way they gestured, the kinds of things that they thought about. An immediate connection formed between them. I think that Begonia also worried a great deal about Beatrice, because Beatrice was a rather dependent and needy type, and one thing about Begonia that was just truly marvelous was that she cared so much about Beatrice, truly loved her, and truly made her feel that she would never be rejected.
Beatrice being the one who thought she was her twin.
So her
reaction in some ways was to be very protective of the emotions of the woman she grew up with as her sister.
Yes.
Then we have Delia. She was the one of the two identical twins who was separated and lived a life apart from her twin and with a family whom she was not related to. How did she react?
Delia also went through the shock, the disbelief, and the eventual acceptance that Begonia did. And many things that puzzled Delia over the years, why she looked so different from her two younger sisters and why she was so different from them, all kind of came clear to her. She understood things that she never understood before. And the tragic part about Delia's situation was that she developed leukemia when she was 16. And Begonia, of course, would have been the perfect donor for bone marrow had she been available, but this was never known, and Delia was forced to undergo a much riskier procedure. But I think that what Delia and Begonia both together were experiencing was this loss of a truly marvelous relationship that they could have had, had they been raised together as they should have been, because the connection between them was almost immediate. I will say, though, that they didn't really have the opportunity to develop that relationship because of all the pressures from other family members, from their mother who was devastated, from the other mother and father who just could not believe that the daughter they'd been raising all their lives was not theirs. And then Beatrice, of course, who needed Begonia's protection. So Delia and Begonia had to kind of rely on their relationship almost at a distance. And since I was in Las Palmas and saw them there and have been following them since, they still maintain the closeness, but they really haven't had the opportunity to develop that bond.
Talk a bit, if you would, just about how much Delia and Begonia actually were alike, despite these very different environments they were raised in.
Begonia and Delia were a lot more alike in many ways, despite their different rearing. Neither one of them really went terribly far in school initially, but later on in life, they developed interests that they wanted to pursue. They had the similar way of walking. They had similar tastes and similar opinions on many, many topics. And what really impressed me was how Begonia said that she and Delia could come into understanding so rapidly, something she could not do with Beatrice. Now,
Beatrice being the woman that she had thought was her twin, but not biologically related. Right, yeah, go ahead.
That's correct. She had lived with Beatrice for 28 years, and yet they could not come to the same level of understanding or agreement that she could achieve so readily with Delia.
And then, of course, there are the moms. We have one mom reared what she thought were twins. It turns out one was her own daughter, another a completely unrelated young woman who she loved and adored for having raised her 28 years. We have another mom miles away who's raised a daughter who turns out she's not biologically related to. Do you want to talk a little bit about what it was like for them?
Well, it was shocking for the mothers to suddenly discover that the child they were raising was not really theirs. I remember speaking with Begonia's mother, and she didn't have her husband there. He had died about 6 years earlier, and she said she literally went crazy thinking that this was not her child. She had put all of her trust and faith in the doctors who delivered her babies. Now, she heard the news from her daughters, but the other mother, the one who raised Delia, that mother and father actually heard the news in quite surprising ways. The mother was watching television one day, had the local news on, and apparently Delia had discussed several things with the press, and suddenly the mother heard her neighborhood being mentioned. She heard a baby being mentioned that was born the same day as her daughter, and then she saw her house. And this put together actually told her in some ways that this child was not hers. Now, I was a little surprised at how quickly and willingly she was to believe all this. And it makes me suspect that maybe deep down somewhere there was a doubt, a slight doubt because of Delia's differences in appearance and behavior from the rest of the family, although I can't prove that. But she seemed so willing to believe that this switched baby was hers.
And in Delia's case, and she, again, is the identical twin who was separated and lived with a family not her own in this rural setting, she ended up in a complete rupture with the parents that she was reared with, did not even invite them to her wedding. Why was that?
Delia did not enjoy a close relationship with her parents. In fact, she was largely raised in her grandparents' house. And she didn't get along for many years, and she certainly clashed with her sisters, but she explained her disagreements with her parents as the usual adolescent difficulties that everyone goes through. But when she suddenly learned that she was a member of a totally different family, she kept the news hidden. But when it was finally revealed, she felt that she had no place to go. She was quite torn between staying in that family and leaving. She had an attachment, if not a close relationship, with those parents. She felt that she belonged in that family, even though she was so different. After all, she was raised by them. And she finally contacted an attorney who then suggested she contact a psychiatrist who really said to her, you can't go back there. Now, Begonia's mother was willing to take Delia in as her own daughter, but Delia simply did not regard Begonia's mother as her own mother. She still regarded the mother who reared her as her own, but she felt caught between these two worlds in which she really did not feel comfortable. Now Delia is married, she has an independent life, and I think for the first time she's content.
This was a case of two twins separated by mistake at birth, and then an error that was not discovered until they were already adults. You describe another case in the book, and there are a number, but one that you describe is a case of two twins in Switzerland also separated by error at birth. And the error was discovered when they were, I guess, 7 years old. Do you want to just briefly describe that case? It's very different.
Yes. In a small town called Fribourg, Switzerland, in July 1941, just 1 or 2 days apart, a mother gave birth to identical twins, and another mother gave birth to a single child. And this hospital, very small, had only 12 cribs. And instead of using baby bracelets, they simply hung a little sign on the post of the bed. At any rate, something happened, we don't know what, to cause one of the single babies to be switched with one of the twins. And the mother of the twins was French-speaking, and the mother of the single child was German-speaking. And typically in Fribourg, these different people kept fairly much apart. But the mother of the twins wanted her children to be fluent in the German language. So when the boys were 6 years old, she had them enrolled in the same German-speaking school as a single boy. And suddenly, everybody was struck by the appearance, or the similar appearance, between one of the twins and the single child. Eventually, at a school parade, the father of the twins met the mother of the single boy, and after some discussion, it became quite clear that this was probably a switched-at-birth twin case. The three boys were then sent to Geneva to have 12 very comprehensive days of medical testing. It turned out that a switch had occurred, and it was left to the Justice of the Peace in Fribourg to decide the fate of these children.
And he made the decision to reunite them with their biological parents, right?
Correct. He did. And he made the decision to return them to their families and switch their names.
And what was the impact of that?
Well, the impact was devastating to everybody. The children were totally shocked. 7-year-old children developed close bonds with their families. And not only that, they couldn't speak the language of the family. And the mothers were absolutely devastated. They so loved these children, and parting with them was just torment for everyone involved. I always felt that the boys should have stayed where they were. And because the families lived in the same town, they could have arranged meetings between the families, almost a joint custody. But of course, in the late 1940s, those kinds of arrangements were probably not possible. There were not child development specialists the way we have them now. The importance of attachment between a child and a parent might not have been in place and appreciated the way it is today. So everyone suffered, and they suffer today.
You make the point that despite, you know, the similarities and affinity among identical twins, that in a case where they have been reared apart, it's far better to keep them with the parents who've reared them.
Well, I should say that I've always been a strong advocate for bringing twins together. But I think that at the age of 7, that becomes very, very difficult. And in this particular case, because everyone lived in the same town, arranging for common meetings or joint custody would have been easier if people had thought about that. Now, there was another case I mentioned in the book of 2 pairs of twins, all female, born in Puerto Rico, and the switch was discovered when the children were only 1.5. What had happened here was that one child in each pair had been switched so that each set of parents took home one of their twins and someone else's twin. And the children were eventually switched back at age 2. It was traumatic momentarily for some of the children, but they quickly forgot and adapted to their new families. But it was a painful decision for the parents, and still is, because they came to truly love the babies they'd been raising.
You know, there are issues involved in rearing twins, and one of them is when they go to school, should they be sent to separate classrooms? And I gather sort of the conventional educational wisdom is yes, they need separation and independence. Do you agree?
I could not disagree more. I believe that there should be no single policy for twins, just like there is no single policy for the educating of non-twins. Some identical twins in particular do well when they're together. They're used to being together. They work well together. And I think that in the early years, to have them separate from one another as well as from their parents upon entry into kindergarten and first grade is really a little too much to ask of them. So what I advise teachers to do is to put the children at different tables so they can meet other children and still have a sense of where the other one is. But I really think that you need to take these cases one by one. At the start of every school year, I get inundated with telephone calls and email messages from parents who constantly face school principals who want to keep children apart. And I just don't think this is in the best interest of children. I always believe that children, in their own way, will tell you what's best for them.
Do you advise parents to dress identical twins alike when they're little?
I don't advise parents to dress identical twins alike. I think that what's most important for identical twins is to be called by the proper name. And that is only going to be possible if they dress differently and wear their hair somewhat differently. On the other hand, being an identical twin is a lot of fun. And I think on occasion, identical twins should be allowed to dress the same way if they choose to, just to enjoy that moment here and there. But as they get older, most identical twins choose to dress differently.
You've studied twins for so long. What are the unanswered questions you really want to explore?
There are a lot of questions concerning twins that I'd like to know the answers to. And one is, what causes that fertilized egg to split? We simply don't know. We know a lot more about what causes fraternal twinning. That is, older mothers have a higher tendency to release two eggs at the same time. I would also like to know more about what causes identical twins to be so much alike despite the differences between them. And I would like to know more about the basis of that very strong twin bond that we see between identical twins. I've used words like non-judgmental and intimacy and acceptance to describe that bond. But I'd like to hear more about that from the twins themselves.
Well, Nancy Siegel, it's been interesting. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Nancy Siegel is a professor of psychology at California State Fullerton and director of the Twin Study Center, which she founded in 1991. Her book is called Someone Else's Twin: The True Story of Babies Switched at Birth. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our next guest, Marlene Zook, can get a little defensive on the subject of insects. She's a biology professor at the University of California, Riverside, who spent years studying animal behavior. She says while everyone loves watching eagles nest or observing the social behavior of chimps, fewer appreciate the complex behavior of our six-legged friends. In her new book, she says there's evidence that some insects, including ants and wasps, display individual personalities and learn behaviors not embedded in their genetic code, and that insects show parenting skills and mating rituals that are simply amazing. Marlene Zook has written two previous books and articles which have appeared in several publications, including the New York Times. Her new book is called Sex on Six Legs: Lessons on Love, Life, and Language from the Insect World. Well, Marlene Zook, welcome to Fresh Air. You write in this book that insects bring home the uneasy truth that you don't need a big brain to do big things. Like, for example, learn from others. Can insects learn? Do we see this?
Yeah, insects can learn a lot more than people give them credit for. I think one of the things I tried to do in the book is to counteract this image people have of insects as mindless robots that march around driven by instinct and don't actually respond to their environment. But it turns out they learn all kinds of things. They can, and in fact, not only can they learn, for instance, where their food is or to avoid noxious stimuli, they can even teach each other. So they can teach another insect what to do, which is a really extraordinary accomplishment that not a lot of other animals, even vertebrates that we often think of as pretty smart, can do.
Okay, well, give us an example. I mean, how do we know we're not looking at simply a behavior that's embedded in their genes?
So with the learning, it's a behavior that's called tandem running in ants. It doesn't look hugely dramatic, I will confess. But still, it means that an ant who's found a food source will come back to recruit others to go to the same food source. And anybody who's ever had ants running around their kitchen knows that, you know, you get this trail. You don't just get one ant going back and forth. Well, the other ants find out where to go, not just from the odors that the first ant leaves when it goes back, when she goes back and forth, but also because an ant will find a nest mate and kind of run along beside her, sort of encouraging her where to go. One of the researchers that did this work says that it looks like a parent teaching a child to ride a bicycle, you know, where you're kind of going along next to them and along next to them, and you have your finger kind of, or your hand on the seat, kind of guiding them along. And so they do this and steer the other individual, showing them where to go, and will actually wait for them to catch up and make sure they're going in the right direction and so forth, which, like I said, doesn't look very dramatic. It looks like two ants walking together. But in actual fact, it's teaching. But on top of that, there's at least some social insects that can recognize minute differences in facial appearance, just the way we would. There are wasps that can determine which individual is which based on really subtle distinctions in the black and yellow patterning they get on the head. Just like, you know, you look at someone and look at the relative, you know, width of their nose and their eyebrows and so forth and can tell different people apart. They can do a very similar kind of thing.
Yeah, this is a fascinating experiment that you describe in which somebody actually captures these insects and does a little face painting on them. I can only imagine how this is accomplished. So they put markings on the faces of these. Were they wasps?
They're wasps.
And then what did they observe? How did they know that the wasps were really making these distinctions and these subtle differences?
So you can put two wasps together and they'll interact in a way just like, say, dogs would, where one of them will become kind of the top dog and one of them will become the subordinate. And there's really characteristic behaviors where you can notice that happening. It's the same thing with wasps. You just need to know what to look for. You know, you could do this with any animal where then you say, all right, well, how are they telling? And then afterwards, they'll behave just exactly as if they remember who was dominant and who wasn't dominant when they were interacting before. So they'll, you know, if you put them together again, the one that had won the fight will be dominant and get, say, access to food and so forth. Well, if you take the one that was previously subordinate and you paint it to look dominant, or you take the one that was previously dominant and paint it to look subordinate, you end up with a slight change in behavior. So it's like they'll look at each other and kind of stop as if you saw your friend wearing a mask. And some things about it look familiar, but wait a minute, the face is wrong. You look different. And the wasps have a really similar sort of reaction where they kind of stop and don't behave as though they would to the same individual. I mean, the actual mechanics of doing this, yeah, it is a little funny, and you do spend a lot of time, you know, working with really tiny things. And people who work with stinging insects do have special ways to not get stung and so forth. But
okay, you just got to tell me, how do we take a wasp and give it makeup?
You need to have a very calm wasp, a very calm wasp. Often you can either anesthetize insects. There's a couple of short-acting chemicals you can use, essentially, you know, giving them anesthesia. Or you can chill down insects, and that often slows them down enough that you can do things like that, too. Because remember, insects are cold-blooded, and so anytime you put them in a cold environment, they kind of go into suspended animation. So a lot of people who work with insects do that, too. But the other thing is, and again, this speaks to kind of the insect phobia that I also talk about in the book, that insects are really not out to get you. Certainly, if you pick up a wasp and start messing with her, then yes, she's probably likely to want to sting you if you're not careful. But by and large, it's not like you're constantly having to defend yourself against these, you know, horrible, aggressive insects that if you're not careful will try to, you know, bite your hand off or something. So,
you study crickets a lot, right?
I do.
And you have a fascinating story about going into Hawaii and discovered there are crickets there who are quiet. What was going on and why was that interesting to you?
So we've been working for a long time on a species of cricket that's common all through northern Australia and the Pacific. It's sort of subtropical. It's been introduced to Hawaii. And in Hawaii, I stumbled on this really interesting relationship where the crickets are subject to a parasitic fly. And so the fly can hear the crickets calling. And crickets, of course, call to attract mates. So all the chirping you hear outside when you go outside on a summer night, all of that nice melodious sound is male crickets desperate for sex. Obviously, that's very important for evolution because the more they sing, the more they're going to attract females, and therefore the more they're going to pass their genes on. That's fine. The problem in Hawaii is that these crickets also, by singing, attract the attention of a parasitic fly. The fly can hear the song as well or better than a female cricket. She flies over, a female fly goes over to the cricket, deposits these larvae on and around it. The larvae burrow inside the cricket while the cricket's still alive and live there consuming his tissues for a week or so while he's gradually getting weaker but, you know, is still functioning. So it's like they've got preserved food to eat, the larvae of the fly do. And then eventually, after about a week, they burst out, just like the movie Alien, and kill the cricket, and then the fly pupates in the soil and becomes an adult fly. I got interested in this because from an evolutionary perspective, it's the perfect conflict. The more the male calls, the better it is from an evolutionary perspective, because the more females he's going to attract, so it's a good thing. But the more the male calls, the more flies he's going to attract, which is going to kill him, which is obviously a bad thing. And yet it's the same call that's attracting both kinds of insects. So how does evolution sort out these conflicting selection pressures? And so we've been studying that for quite a long time. The silent cricket that you just mentioned has been a really recent and really exciting development, which is that we noticed on one of the islands where the crickets occurred, we were finding fewer and fewer individuals, and we couldn't, you know, hear as many. I keep them in my lab, and I couldn't find as many females to lay eggs for my lab colony. And eventually I thought, okay, they're just going to go extinct. This is actually an introduced species with an introduced parasite, and sometimes that's unstable. So, all right, never mind. You know, these things are dynamic, and they're just going to go extinct eventually. But one day, we came back, and I didn't hear any crickets at all, but started to go to the field site anyway, figuring, you know, you may as well see if there's anything around. And I started seeing lots and lots and lots of crickets. So there were many more there than had been before, but none of them were making a sound. It turned out that they weren't making a sound not because they were behaviorally refraining from it. It wasn't that they didn't want to. It was that they couldn't. Their wings now show this mutation that renders them completely silent.
So it protects them from the parasite, but what do they do for sex?
Ah, yes, exactly. I mean, it does protect them from the parasite because the fly can't find them if they can't call. But of course, then the female shouldn't be able to find them either. It turns out that it's not all the males that show this mutation. About 10 to 15% of the males are still normal winged callers, as per usual, and those can attract females just like any male could. The silent males, the ones that now have this mutation, get very close to the callers, hang around them, and in so doing, kind of take advantage of the females that are attracted to the callers and can mate with them as they move toward the singing males.
There's a lot of interesting stuff in this book about sex, reproduction, mating. And you found that the competition among males to reproduce has some interesting manifestations. And in many cases, that competition occurs after they mate. They have these particular physical adaptations to make theirs the sperm that does the job. Give us an example or two of this.
Sure. Insects are a great way to study how sex isn't really over when it's over. People tend to think that after mating has happened, well, since you can't see anything, then that must be it and everything is just finished. But in insects, and as it's turning out in lots of other animals, but insects are a great way to study this, if a female insect mates with more than one male in pretty rapid succession, as lots of insects do, then there's an opportunity for the sperm of those males. So the males themselves are long gone, but there's an opportunity for the sperm of those males to compete inside the body of the female in a process that's called sperm competition. And males have lots of tricks that they use to get their sperm to fertilize the eggs rather than another male's. So, for example, in damselflies, they've got these special scoops on the intermittent organ, the penis, in effect, of the male, that they can use to drag out the sperm from a previous male and replace it with their own.
Wow. And what's the evolutionary value of that? Why would a species in which males have that ability be more likely to survive? I mean, why would one individual's sperm be better than another? Why is that better for the survival and propagation of the species?
It's not that it's necessarily better for the species as a whole, but pretty much everything we see in evolution happens because it perpetuates the individual's genes that are, you know, doing whatever it is. So, no, it's not necessarily better for the species, but it means that if I am able to displace the sperm of another male, then the genes for being able to displace the sperm of another male are going to be the ones that fertilize the eggs of the female that I just displaced the sperm from another male in. And so her offspring are all going to be able to displace sperm. Well, guess what happens? You end up with a population in which everybody can do this, and there's competition among the males to do it the best.
Now, there are also ways in which males try and get females to accept their sperm, right? I mean, some fascinating examples of that.
In a lot of Orthoptera, like crickets and katydids and their relatives, males produce sperm that's external. It's in a little package called a spermatophore. But in these species, it's attached to what's called a spermatophylax, which is this big globby thing that is has a lot of protein in it. It's very nutritious. And the female eats it while the sperm are draining into her body. Now, the males have to produce this before the female will mate. If he just goes up to her and just has the little sperm package, she won't mate with him. If he gives her the spermatophylax, she will mate with him. But the bigger and more nutritious it is, the longer she spends eating it, and therefore the more of his sperm drain into her body and fertilize her eggs. So there's a lot of selection on males to produce this very costly, what's called a nuptial gift. And it can often weigh up to 30% of the male's body weight.
There's some remarkable stuff in here about parenting, taking care of eggs, raising kids. And it's interesting to discover that there are plenty of cases where the dads take care, right?
Oh, absolutely. And let me point out that insects make great parents. One beautiful example that if people go out to streams and rivers, especially in parts of the American Southwest, that they can see are giant water bugs. And giant, of course, is a relative term. They're probably, maybe a little bit bigger than a dollar coin or something like that, which is, you know, big for a bug. And they live in streams. And the males actually carry around the eggs on their back for the whole time that the eggs are incubating. And then when they hatch, sometimes they'll take care of them a little bit more. Sometimes they'll just let them go. But the moms just lay the eggs on the back of the male and then swim off and never care in the world.
Any idea why that happens?
It's kind of a hard row to hoe for fathers to be the main caregivers because, of course, in insects, as in lots of other animals, it's never entirely certain that the father is actually the father of the offspring that come out of the eggs that the female laid because, of course, the fertilization happened inside the body of the female. And so she can lay these eggs and you can have mated with her, but what if she mated with somebody else? And so this is called certainty of paternity, and it means that in some cases at least, there's not a lot of payoff for males to take care of their babies because the babies might not really be genetically theirs. In the case of the water bugs, though, it's very clever because the female puts the eggs on the male's back before they're fertilized, and so then the male can put his sperm on them and they're absolutely certain to be his.
Now, you also find cases where insects eat their babies, or at least their eggs. Give us an example and tell us why this makes evolutionary sense.
Again, it's one of these things where sometimes doing something that seems drastic in the short term but pays off in the long term is really a good idea. For example, if you have a lot of eggs and the breeding season is kind of going on and on, you're not able to find a lot of food for yourself, you're going to be better off by eating some of those eggs, consuming them, and so, of course, they'll never survive, but the ones that remain will get the protection that you can give them by hanging on long enough to take care of them. So it's a way of sacrificing the few for the sake of the rest.
And we also see siblicide, right? I mean, young coming out and eating their brothers and sisters.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, it is often kind of a larva-eat-larva world out there. So if insects are all in the same place, or if the babies are all in the same place, then the first one that hatches will often have as its first act consuming an egg that's next to it that hasn't had the good fortune to hatch yet. And so siblicide turns out to be quite common. And again, it's one of these things where if you can pass your genes on better by doing it, then that's just what's going to happen.
Now, you also have this fascinating chapter on communication among insects. And you cite an example of how bees, where a hive has gotten big and a portion of the bees in the hive are going to go out and start a new one, will collectively scout out a location and then communicate, in effect, kind of have a debate and a decision about where they're going to go. Describe this.
So this is one of the most, I think, understudied and remarkable things that insects can do. We talk about complexity of behavior. They have complex decision-making. And, you can liken it to finding a new place to live. Imagine if every time you found a new house, you had to find it with thousands and thousands of, your friends and relations. Well, in this case, it's all your relations, but anyway. And you all had to agree on exactly where to go, exactly when to go there, and how to find your way. So bees seem to be able to do this by sending out scouts. So they'll send out a few individuals. When a hive is ready to split, they'll send out a few individuals that will go looking for an appropriate place to live and then come back and perform a dance behavior that indicates where this place might be. And by sort of putting the various dances together that the different individuals do, the bees are actually able to come to a consensus about where they're going to go. And then once they've reached that consensus, they all go there. And this is an amazing ability, again, because their brains are so small. And this is one of the reasons that insects are so cool to study, that we think decision-making is a tremendously complicated thing. It requires, your forebrain. It requires your cerebral cortex. It requires all this gray matter. Bees don't have any of that, and yet they seem to be able to do exactly the same thing. One of the people studying the bees said, it makes you wonder, what are we doing with our brains? What are they for?
Well, just to be clear about this, we're talking about a case where the dance isn't one bee describing a single, new location for a potential hive. There are actually multiple locations that are being described.
So each dancer will describe a place where it has been. And then eventually the hive sort of weighs all of the various places and goes to one of them. And exactly how they do this and exactly what the criteria are for going for one place over another is still really being studied right now by lots of scientists.
Well, Marlene Zook, it's been interesting. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Marlene Zook's book is called Sex on Six Legs, Lessons on Love, Life, and Language from the Insect World. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan on a disturbing novel about child-rearing in the digital age. This is Fresh Air. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says Helen Schulman's This Beautiful Life is a finely wrought literary novel that should come wrapped in yellow caution tape. Here's her review and her warning.
I've been on a roll this summer reading and reviewing good novels about family crises. Rachel Dawoskin's Big Girl Small, Dana Spiota's Stone Arabia, Kevin Wilson's The Family Fang. But this latest domestic drama is one I recommend with a big caveat, especially if you happen to be a parent. Make sure you start Helen Schulman's new novel, This Beautiful Life, on a Friday night, so that when you find yourself compelled to stay up all hours reading it, you can take the rest of the weekend not only to recover, but to think long and hard about the advantages for your kids of homeschooling, cloistered convents, kibbutzes, monasteries, and ashrams, or perhaps a semester abroad program in Antarctica. You think I jest, but This Beautiful Life is one scary story, made more so by Schulman's great gifts as a close and often funny observer of upper-class social customs. Here's the situation. The Bergamot family moves from idyllic Ithaca to New York City when the dad, Richard, accepts a high-level administrative position at a Columbia-type university. Mom, Liz, has a PhD in art history, but she's put her own fuzzy career ambitions on hold to raise son Jake, who's now 15, and daughter Coco, 6. The Bergamots find themselves plunked into the world of elite private schools, which include kindergarten sleepovers at the Plaza Hotel and birthday party chartered cruises around Manhattan. In the contemporary comedy of manners tradition of a novel like Alison Pearson's I Don't Know How She Does It, Schulman, through Liz's alienated perspective, dissects the various cliques standing outside Coco's elementary school at pickup time. Here's a sampling. The Japs with the Japs, the headbanded preppy moms with the preppies, the stray earth mother in Birkenstocks with a baby in a sling. Next on the food chain, the caregivers, a couple of grad students reading Kierkegaard or Sartre and listening to their iPods, the small dark fortress of the Caribbean nannies. Liz saw a clutch of yummy mummies at the foot of the steps. She knew queen bees when she saw them. They were tall in their metallic sandals, their skinny yoga butts trim in their designer jeans. Only experience told her that when these ladies turned away from their gabby circle to place a cell phone call to their driver or decorator or art consultant, that the skin on their faces would be pure leather. Fraught with tension as that female gauntlet may be, the consequences of a social misstep proved to be much more dire in Jake's teenaged world. At an unchaperoned house party one weekend, Jake attracts the attentions of a lust-struck eighth-grade girl. He rebuffs her, sort of, but undeterred, she sends him a homemade, sexually explicit video later that night. Jake freaks out when he sees the video in the privacy of his room, and out of a mixture of fright and sexual braggadocio, he forwards the girl's email to a guy friend, who then sends it on to his friends. Schulman describes the burgeoning virtual disaster this way. By Monday, it was all over school. Kids were downloading it and watching it in the library. Kids were finding it on porno sites. It was all over the country, maybe the world even. So fast, just like that. Forward and send. It was kind of incredible how fast it went, faster than fire, practically the speed of sound or even light. Within weeks, the flourishing future that the Bergamot family envisioned for itself has withered, all because of a few impulsive adolescent finger clicks on the computer. What sets This Beautiful Life apart from, say, your average Lifetime Movie of the Week domestic drama is not only Schulman's closely observed depictions of the Bergamot family's collapse, but also her smart dramatization of how powerless we all are before the mighty, privacy-dissolving force of the Internet. At the climax of the novel, a distressed Liz cries to her husband about their children, "I don't know how to protect them. The genie's out of the bottle. It's in the air. That last line sounds like it could have come out of a 1950s horror movie. Indeed, as wry and entertaining as Shulman's social observations are, it's the totally convincing nightmare aspect of her novel that will keep parental readers up at night, wondering how on earth to pull the drawbridges up and shutter the windows against this most potent, invisible home invader.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed This Beautiful Life by Helen Shulman. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Anne Marie Baldonado, John Myers, John Sheehan, and Heidi Simon. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.